Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
Pink Martini has been causing a sensation all over the world, and we have as our guest today its pianist and founder. Hello.
Hello.
Welcome to Crossover, Thomas Lauderdale.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, a lot of people don't know who you are. And as a matter of fact, the wonderful ensemble that you have created is very new to many, many people. Pink Martini, what a wonderful name. How did that come about?
You know, it all started in 1994. I had just come back from college. I went to Harvard and came back to Oregon because I had a contract with the Oregon Symphony to play a couple of concerti. And at the time, I was also heavily, really interested in politics. And so I brought, so I was working on various campaigns in Oregon. And actually, there was this one sort of very terrible attempt to illegalize homosexuality in the state of Oregon in 1994. And I was working on the campaign in opposition to this. And I had just seen Pee Wee Herman's Christmas special on television. And that's, if you've ever seen that Christmas special, it's really unbelievable because in 45 minutes, you've got every guest star imaginable. You've got Frankie Avalon, Annette Funicello, Grace Jones, Charo, Katie Lang, Diane Shore. And so the Del Rubio triplets were three gals, three guitars, somewhere between the ages of 70 and 80, wearing mini skirts, playing guitars, singing covers of Walk Like an Egyptian and Whip It. And I thought that they were just unbelievable. So my thought was to bring them to Oregon to do a series of concerts in nursing homes and retirement homes and hospitals. And at the end of the week, we had a gigantic, you know, huge concert, and I needed really an opening act. And the surf band who I really wanted to hire wasn't returning my calls. So I decided to start a band for just one night, and the right name of that band seemed to be Pink Martini.
Oh well, of course it conjures up all kinds of visions. Of course, a cosmopolitan, but more than that, it's very offbeat, and what you do is really very unusual. You kind of put things together that one doesn't expect, and yet there is a sophistication about the music that you play. Now, just to backtrack, you are a pianist, is that right?
That's right. I grew up in Indiana, studying with a wonderful woman named Patricia Garrison, and I studied just classical piano, and sort of the thought of anything outside of classical piano for me, up through high school and part of college really was unthinkable. It was all classical.
Well, now, did you want to be a musician? To concertize as a musician? You know, I mean, what you went to Harvard, and I'm sure you weren't going to make music your career. Was that certainly wasn't?
That's forefront. Right. I mean, I kind of figured out halfway through high school that the people who I knew who were going off to music schools weren't very fun. They weren't very broadly educated, and just the thought of being sort of stuck in a practice room for 8 hours a day didn't seem like a good time to me.
A lot of work,
and also just a lot of sort of like solitude.
Yes, exactly.
I really, really wanted to be with a lot of people, and so the thought of going to probably a liberal arts college like Harvard really seemed right to me. And in the end, you know, it was sort of perfect for me because I lived in a really wonderfully diverse, international house called Adams House at Harvard, which is where I met China Forbes, the person who eventually became the singer of the band.
Who is really marvelous as well. Excellent. Really very, very versatile. The whole thing, the whole impression, and as I say, when I received all the material, I got kind of pangs of nostalgia as well. Some of the music that you're playing, and on one of your albums, I think it's Sympathique, you play Amado Mio. Well, I remember seeing Rita Hayworth in Gilda, or Gilda, however they pronounce it.
Right.
And she
right.
sang it in a black satin strapless gown. And she
That's
sang
right.
this song. And when I saw this, I said, where did he find this? You play it kind of straight. I mean, you're not really,
You know, at the beginning of the band, where the band first started, when we played at that Snow on 13 fundraiser with the Del Rubio triplets, it was really a very campy.
Campy, that's exactly
it
what it is.
Very campy.
Yeah, that's what it feels like. It was kind of like a spoof, really.
That's right. But then as we sort of like marched on, and I sort of soon figured out that this is actually probably going to be a really viable thing, and we found ourselves playing at fundraisers for every progressive cause in town.
So it was you were kind of politically oriented still.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We were doing fundraisers for libraries and civil rights and affordable housing and the environment.
I guess thinking people that are aware of issues that are going on and would appreciate you. But this again is an intellectual group, a certain level of culture, I think, and understanding of what's going on. And this is the audience that you appealed to, I would think, if you were doing those functions.
Yeah, it was. Portland, Oregon is a pretty progressive place. And it's, affectionately disaffectionately at the time was known as Little Beirut.
Okay.
Called that by George Bush Sr. Because the protests were always the largest whenever he came to town. but it's a very it's a city with a conscience, and it's also full of artists because it's comparatively inexpensive. So it's possible to have kind of a career as a musician or a writer and not
survive,
go bankrupt.
Yeah, I know. Well, anyone who makes that decision to go into the arts has to be aware of what the hardship is. I mean, it's a very, very, as you say, especially for a pianist, there's a great deal of solitude of practicing and so on, and then concertizing and just being different because you're not part of the orchestra. It's one of those things. I mean, all musicians, I think, go through this reckoning with themselves at some point in their life. Is this really what I should be doing? But I guess this is a kind of a surprise to you that this is what you wound up doing. I mean, this is what you do, isn't it?
Well, I really thought that I was going to go into politics. But I think through the years, as the band grew from four people to now there are 12 of us, all of whom come from completely different backgrounds. So there are some hardcore jazz musicians in the band.
Well, I see you have a harpist in there.
The harpist, Maureen Love, who is the sister of Mike Love from the Beach Boys and the cousin of Brian Wilson.
Oh, my.
Maureen Love is incredible because she lives in Portland, Oregon, and she always wanted to be a rock star, but because she was a woman, she never really got to be. And sort of the most amazing thing for me now, one of the most wonderful aspects of the band is that she, in a sense, gets to be the rock star running around the world and playing with us.
But it does add certainly a touch of class, you must say. So,
but, from the beginning swells of Amado Mio to
yes.
the atmosphere that the harp provides in a piece like Bolero
yes.
by Ravel or Que Sera Sera, it just, life is better with harp and string.
Yes, I agree with you completely. Absolutely. Now, you also have, again, a very sophisticated repertoire in the sense that it's very cosmopolitan, it's international. Once again, a question, do you have themes, for instance, for your albums? I mean, do you do like a Latin album or
not really. I mean, I guess the idea really with any set of music that we play, whether it's a set list or an album, is to kind of really create a very diverse set of music, which is somehow dissimilar and yet not too incohesive that it doesn't make sense, if it makes sense. So in the course of, like, you know, one album, there are maybe songs in five or six different languages, from like, you know, a classical piece like Song of the Black Swan by Villa-Lobos to sort of a swing 1930s feel to a song called Hang On Little Tomato that we wrote. Hang On Little Tomato is the title of the second album, and that was actually inspired, the words of that were inspired by an advertisement for Hunt's Ketchup, and the original ad read, Hang On Little Tomato, stay on the vine till you're fat and juicy. Then we will pluck you and boil you in secret bubbly spices, turn you into ketchup, and if you're lucky, some smart hamburger may team up with you.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I just thought that was just so unbelievable.
It is.
Simultaneously sort of delightful and sinister.
Yes.
And it made the perfect fodder for a song.
So, again, you have a universal appeal, and of course, you're really a tremendous hit, I think, wherever you go. And I read somewhere you are composing. Are you a composer as well? You want to do an operatic version of Bambi, I read somewhere.
Oh,
is that correct?
Actually, a ballet.
Oh, okay.
Not operatic, but ballet at some point. I never really considered myself a composer, but that's sort of that's definitely, you know, part of what's happened with the band. I would say that a lot of the people in the band do contribute in terms of writing songs and arranging them. China Forbes, for example, is a huge songwriter and comes from that sort of like tradition of songwriting that she's actually much more comfortable writing songs, I think, than I am. But there are other members of the band, such as Martin Zarzar, who is one of the percussionists from Peru, who has written some songs, as well as Phil Baker, a bass player, Robert Taylor, who plays the trombone,
yes,
who grew up in Taylorville, Illinois, who studied with every brass player in the Chicago Symphony.
Well, not bad.
And is an unbelievable trombonist who can really cross over from classical symphonic traditions to jazz, to Afro-Cuban, to Brazilian, and really, I think is one of the most exciting musicians in the band, certainly.
Well, I know you had a very heavy schedule, and you're now in Washington. You're playing with the National Symphony, is that right?
Yes.
How?
Yep.
I mean, the band is playing with the symphony.
Yes.
Okay. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, you know, it's I mean, because the music itself is often really feels like a Hollywood musical of the 1940s.
Uh-huh.
Crossed with a sort of a United Nations sort of message. It really made sense to orchestrate a lot of the pieces of the band so that we could actually play with a full symphony orchestra.
Is that the only orchestra that you've done this with, or is this going to be something?
We did maybe 30 different orchestras across the country.
Uh-huh.
We played with the San Francisco Symphony and the Los Angeles Philharmonic, the Hollywood Bowl several times, Seattle, Omaha, Bismarck, Mandan, Jacksonville, Florida, Nashville, probably, you know, several orchestras in Texas, altogether probably about 30 different orchestras in this country. And actually, because we're an independent band that is on our own record label, really the only way at the beginning of our career here in the United States, the only way to really have a career was to play with a symphony orchestra.
Well, you are what, 12 pieces, right?
That's right.
Okay, so you're a chamber ensemble, basically,
right.
I guess. And then you work with the larger orchestras. How long have you actually been in existence? What was the year where you really, really started?
1994 is when we started.
So it's a while yet. I mean, I guess it went very, very fast. And you've made three albums now, is that right?
Three albums. And you know, we really had a career first, even more so than the States. We started really having a bigger career abroad, in France especially. And
how do you explain your appeal? This is what I wanted to ask you. You definitely would appeal to a French audience. I know it. I mean, I can tell by certainly listening to your things and then knowing that you've played all over the world. But there is definitely something very cosmopolitan about what you do. If you can call a sound cosmopolitan, it's a style. It's a philosophy. It's really much, much more than just sitting down and reading notes. I mean, you've got the essence of something in Pink Martini, which is almost impossible to describe.
Well, I think it's a certain kind of diplomacy, as well as an urban diplomacy, maybe. Does that make sense? I would say that, like, you know, a lot of our music is music of the world without being world music. And it's very urban simultaneously, and there's an element of ambassadorship and diplomacy to it. You know, whenever we go to a different country, we try to at least communicate a few thoughts in the language of whatever country we're in, whether that's, you know, most recently Romania or Turkey or Serbia.
Well, it's respect. It's respect for their culture, in a sense, I guess. And then
What I often sort of like think of this project as is kind of the ultimate sort of like modern American project, in a sense that America is really sort of in reality a hugely diverse country full of people from every language, every culture, every nation, every religion. And in a sense, the music that we play kind of reflects that diversity that really is America.
Or is music. Music is a language, and music is the language of the entire universe, I guess. You can go to any country.
And it crosses over.
Yes.
Again, it crosses over into every culture.
Right.
And so, you know, in a sense, just, you know, what the New York Philharmonic has just been doing in North Korea.
Right.
Is precisely, I think, part of our goal as we travel both inside the United States and out of it.
So, again, now, what is your future schedule look like? Are you touring a great deal? Do you kind of settle down in Portland for any period of time?
We're sort of like on for a month and then off for a month in general throughout the year. And so now we're in the midst of an East Coast tour until the end of March, and then we're back in Portland for a little while, and then we go back on the road, I think in May to California, maybe on the West Coast a bit, and then we're going to be in Europe, I believe, this summer, and Canada, and possibly South America and Mexico later in the autumn.
So I mean, you this is it for you. This is what you do. You will be touring and will continue expanding your repertoire, I guess.
That's the hope. Yes.
You know, I read something in one of the publicity blurbs about you. You had said that nothing in your apartment was made after 1967. And that was the year that the Polaroid Land Camera was built. Well, I just heard that the Polaroid Company, of course, is now defunct, but they're putting their logo or their name on other things. So let's hope that that doesn't happen with Pink Martini.
Oh, yeah. It's so sad to find out that actually the Polaroid Land Camera is, they're not going to be making that film anymore. The good news is that Fuji does make the film that goes with this Polaroid Land Camera. So, and it may be actually even better. So,
well, of course, Fuji is Japanese. So, on that note, thank you so much. I really appreciate your giving us the interview. I hope to see you when you play at the Kimmel Center. We're really looking forward to it.
See you soon.
Okay, Thomas. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.